morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of A Pen and a Napkin Podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to our interview series, episode number 276 by my count, but I teach history, so I don't know really how to count, so we're just going to say that right here, right now. Excited to have a little East Coast flavor here today. Christina Danella from Glen Ridge High School in Glen Ridge, New Jersey. Excited to have her on here. Won a state championship this year. We're going to get to that. We're going to talk about that here in just a bit. Before we get to Coach Danella, we, of course, want to thank our founding sponsor, Cosette Chiropractic, located at 144th and Maple here in Omaha. Coaches, if you have or any of your athletes are struggling with balanced neck or spinal issues, go see Dr. Kevin or Dr. Heidi, 402-964-0300. Follow us on Twitter at A Pen and a Napkin. We try to put out daily coaching tidbits on the Twitter handle, so be sure to follow us there. If you're listening, whether you're in Nebraska, Iowa, New Jersey, Wisconsin, Tanzania, wherever you may be, download, rate, review, give us 5 stars. Subscribe, if you would, please. Move up the ratings faster when folks do those type of things, so please do that. Questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas, email me, apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Enough of that, Coach Danella. Let's get to you. Let's talk about my favorite person who is currently on the phone from New Jersey right here, right now. I thought I heard Bruce Springsteen or Bon Jovi playing in the background. Coach Danella, how you doing this fine Monday afternoon?
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Excited to talk here. Let's jump right into it, Coach. Tell us a little bit about your basketball journey. It's been a one with a lot of twists and turns to it, but been successful pretty much everywhere that you've been. So tell us about your basketball journey.
Sure. Okay. So I grew up in New Jersey. I went to the prestigious Redbank Catholic High School. And still to this day, I am the all-time leading scorer and all-time leading rebounder in RBC history, as well as a Hall of Fame inductee, I should say, which happened in 2024. Awesome. After I graduated in 2008, I went on to the University of Massachusetts, where I played Division I basketball for 2 years there. After my sophomore year, I made the jump to Marist College, and we had a really, really good run at Marist. We won our conference both years that I was there, made it to the NCAA tournament. We actually won an NCAA game, so that was super, super exciting.
Oh,
we were we were the 13 seed, and we upset Georgia, the number 4 seed.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay.
So it was a big one, big one for us.
Yeah, SEC school. Yeah, that's
exactly. Yeah, it was really cool, and when Andy Landers was there. Oh. So it was, it was a big one.
You're dating yourself there, if Andy Landers. Maybe you just drove him into retirement.
I know. So that was great. And after I graduated in 2013, I had 2 degrees: psychology and special education. I got right into college coaching. So my first stop was at Urbana University, which was a Division II school in Ohio, but unfortunately it did close down since. But I was a graduate assistant. And then 4 days before our first game, there were some changes in leadership, and I was elevated to head coach, and I was the youngest head coach in America at the time.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a really, really great experience. I mean, talk about being thrown into the fire. Yeah. I was 22 years old and the head coach of a Division II school, which, I mean, it was such a good experience. We had the best year in school history, which was just, it was honestly incredible. I had 2 players on my team that were actually older than me, which was funny. A great experience for sure. And after Urbana, I decided to come back home to Jersey, and I was the head coach at Caldwell University. And also at Caldwell, I was the associate athletic director, which was, I mean, essentially 2 full-time jobs in one. Yeah. It was a lot of work. But again, another great experience. Division II, I was there for 3 years. We had phenomenal years there. I got the opportunity to coach a second team All-American, which was, I mean, it's just incredible when you have talent like that. So, mm-hmm. after Caldwell, I was looking for just a coaching job. I mean, the administrative side of things taught me a lot, but I loved coaching. So I decided to travel 3,000 miles away and go to San Francisco State and become the head coach there. My interview was the first time I was ever in California. And it was definitely an experience. It's the largest Division II institution in the entire country. And San Francisco is definitely a lot different from New Jersey. So I learned a lot that year. I learned how different just recruiting out there is and how big the junior college circuit is out there, because in New Jersey and on the East Coast, it's really not that big of a thing. And out West, it's huge. Mm-hmm. So that it was definitely a learning experience out there. And some family things went on and I decided to come back home to the East Coast. And that's when I made the transition to Division III. And I was the head coach at Keystone College, where in my last year there, we won the conference championship for the first time in school history. And then COVID happened.
Yeah.
So that's when I actually got out of the college coaching game and transitioned to being a teacher and coaching at the high school level.
Mm-hmm. And you've had a couple stops since then, right?
I have. So I started out at Mount Olive High School, which is a really big high school in New Jersey, but not a strong basketball presence. They're really good in other sports, but just not basketball. So I spent 2 years there. Then I went to Sparta High School and I spent a year there. And now I am the head coach at Glen Ridge. And we just came off of an absolutely incredible year. It was a dream season for us. First time in school history winning the state championship. Just a lot of firsts for us at Glen Ridge this year.
Yeah. So you have never been an assistant coach.
Yeah. It's wild. It's so crazy to me. So I've been extremely lucky and I love it.
What do you think are some of the positives of that? And what are some of the negatives perhaps of never having, you know, just been an assistant coach and learning from somebody else per se?
Sure. I mean, I think it's a little twofold. Like, I get to do things the way I've kind of been taught, and how I've been taught is just through my playing experience and from just watching other coaches coach. But I do think I struggle at times because I never have been an assistant. So I haven't been able to sit behind somebody. All I know is my coaches from high school, obviously, and then UMass and Marist, and then what I see on TV and when I go to practices and whatnot. So I think it's great in a sense, but at the same time, there are times where I would love to sit behind those top coaches just to learn from them, because I feel like I didn't really get to learn. I never got to learn as an assistant coach because I wasn't one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of our newest categories of the podcast, the Karen Self, a pen and a napkin moment. Coach, when was the first time that you remember getting out a pen and a piece of paper or perhaps a napkin and, you know, just starting scribbling and writing and putting things down and getting fascinated with the X's and O's of the game?
Oh, wow. I remember in high school, and I remember that we had all of our offenses, and that's what I would do during class. I hate to say it, but I would sit there and I would draw out our plays because, I mean, that's how I learned. And now as a teacher, especially, I'm a special ed teacher. I see how kids learn so differently and how you have to just adjust to everybody. So what I do with my kids, we videotape all our plays. We run through our plays a million times. I write it out for them so that they get it for their binders. I mean, there's just, so you can't really have an excuse for not knowing the plays.
Mm-hmm.
So it just depends on what kind of learner they are. But I remember, I mean, high school was the earliest I remember it. And I mean, to this day, I always sit right with my pen and paper at my coffee table. And during the NCAA tournament, I go crazy with it because there's so many things that you can learn from what's on TV. And it doesn't always have to be the UConns of the world and those South Carolinas. Like, there's so much stuff that I learned from honestly, I got so much good stuff from Tennessee Tech last year. It's so crazy to say. I would have never thought that. Mm-hmm. But so many of their out of bounds plays are amazing, and I stole all of them. So it's great.
Mm-hmm. Or it could be Marist against Georgia circa 2000 and, you know,
right.
2000 and blah, 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 blah. I can't remember the exact. Yeah, there you go. So, obviously you were a highly successful player, 1,000 point scorer in college between the two stops together. Like, so you got a chance to play and win in the NCAA tournament. Mm-hmm. So how do you think your experiences as a player have helped you in your journey as a coach and in your coaching career? Again, like we said, you've never been an assistant coach, so you've had to rely on a lot of those experiences as a player.
Right. I mean, basketball has brought me so many amazing opportunities of who we've played against and just what the sport has brought to me. And when I was at UMass, I had 5 female coaches that were honestly the most incredible people I could ever ask for. And that's why I chose them in the first place. And I learned so much from them, just about life and how much it's bigger than basketball. Mm-hmm. They taught me so much. And then when I got to Marist, I mean, Coach Georges is truly one of the best, and he's amazing. He's retired since I've been out, but he taught me so much about basketball, and so many X's and O's that I still use to this day are all based upon what he taught me. So I try to just take all of my experiences and bring it towards what I'm doing today. And just, life is so much bigger than basketball, and it's given me the most amazing opportunities, but I want to just give back to the game. And if I could just teach my players one thing, that's great.
Mm-hmm. You, like you said, your journey has been kind of, you know, an interesting lesson in American geography. How about that? You know, Ohio, California, New Jersey, you know, one of the biggest things that you've done, of course, is you started out as a college coach, and then you went off and now you are a high school coach. And I kind of went on that same type of journey in my earlier days. Started out as a college coach, college assistant, and then ended up in the high school level. You know, for you, what were some of the biggest differences between being a college coach and a high school coach, and how you run your program, how you coach your players, all of those different things there? You know, how do you manage or what have you learned, and how do you do things differently in those situations?
Right. I mean, I think obviously the biggest one is just recruiting and how at the college level I could get players geared towards my system. And then obviously at the high school level, you're, especially at a public school, I mean, you're just given the players that are coming up. And I feel like at the college level, I got to recruit the kids that I wanted towards the system that I wanted to play. Yeah. And at the high school level, I mean, I've had to make tweaks every single year because the offenses that I ran in college, sometimes we don't have the personnel in the high school level. Like, for example, this year at Glen Ridge, we were massive. We had the biggest team I've ever coached, college or high school. We were huge. Our starting five was massive. So, I mean, one of the biggest high schools that I've ever seen. And we're an extremely small number-wise high school. So it was just incredible that we had 6'3", 6'1", 6'1", 6', and then a 5'8 kid. Like, that's just incredible at the high school level, especially at a Group 1 in Jersey. So I definitely had to make some tweaks because we weren't super guard-oriented, and we weren't great shooters, which I've always, at the college level, that's what I kind of recruited towards. I always wanted shooters because that was the system that we were running. So making alterations to what we were exactly running. But I coach my kids hard. I mean, I know it's different at the college and high school levels, but I still have extremely high expectations and I coach them hard. But at the end of the day, they know that I want the best for them and the team. And like I keep saying, it's so much bigger than basketball. So I just hope that I can learn, teach them just lessons that I've learned along the way. Mm. And Yeah, the wins are amazing. I mean, yes, we remember the state championships and whatnot, but there's so many other things outside of that that are so much more.
Mm-hmm. Youth sports today has become a billion-dollar industry nationwide, and grassroots basketball has been at the epicenter of this explosion. These days, players, parents, and handlers chase the almighty scholarship, NIL deals, and branding creation. However, there is still one place where basketball coaches and players come to develop their games without the fanfare and adulation of recruiting gurus, next-level evaluations, and social media highlight reels. It's not a basketball camp. It's a basketball school. Snow Valley Basketball School started as the brainchild of Herb Livesey, who, as a young adult, was inspired by the great Bob Cousy to start his own basketball camp. Starting in 1961 at Snow Valley Ski Resort, east of Los Angeles, before moving to Westmont College in Santa Barbara, Livesey's school was a place for the game's greatest coaches to teach the game throughout the 1970s and 80s. Two Iowans, Don Showalter and Jerry Slykus, adopted Livesey's curriculum, bringing the school to Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa in 1994. This summer will be a celebration of its 30th anniversary of Snow Valley in the Hawkeye State. Here, over 1,400 campers will start each day before dawn and end after the sun goes down. Snow Valley Basketball School is America's longest continuously running basketball camp. It's where players come to learn and coaches come to teach. For those that come there every summer, it is the home to the last of the Cowboys. The Last of the Cowboys, the story of Snow Valley Basketball School, will be available on Amazon on July 1st, 2025. Paperback copies will be available for $17.99, while Kindle copies will be available for pre-order for $9.99. Get to know the story of America's longest continuous basketball camp. Coach, let's talk a little bit about, you know, your experiences outside of your formal coaching situations here. You have done some stuff with Breakthrough Basketball and doing some fundamental work, skill work, etc. Jersey Cardinals, AAU, that type of thing, you know. So you're coaching some kids that you are not going to be working with on a daily basis, whether it's obviously not at the collegiate level, but even at the high school level, you're going to be coaching some kids from other schools. Maybe it's kids you play against later on in the season or whatever it may be. So, you know, how has coaching players that are not your own for these short bursts of time, a weekend with an AAU team or for 2 or 3 days in a camp, how has that made you a better coach and a better coach for your program when you go back to it at Glen Ridge?
Right. I mean, Breakthrough Basketball has been absolutely amazing to me. And if there's anybody listening that has kids that want to go to a camp, I mean, Breakthrough Basketball is amazing. There's camps all over the country. We run them all over in every single state. But I love those camps because I get 2 to 3 days with these kids and it's boys and girls. So I get to coach boys a little bit, which is always, I mean, it's so different than coaching girls. And when I get into the higher grade levels, I get to coach high school boys sometimes, and that's just a whole different game to me. So it's really interesting, and I just get to meet kids from all over the place. I get to go up to Portland, Maine, and coach these kids, and they come back year after year, and I love that. They keep in touch with me on Instagram, and it's just so cool to see their journey that a few years ago, they were just little kids that were just learning how to shoot the ball. And then I check on social media and now they're starting for their high school teams. Like, yeah. It's so incredible to see. And even though it is short and we only have a few hours with the kids, I try to make a relationship with each of the kids and just get to know a little bit about them. And some obviously stick more than others, but it's been a really, really nice experience for me to just get to coach kids different than just my typical high school kids. And then a lot of the camps that I do are actually 3rd through 8th grade. So okay, it's a lot different than my high school kids. So I get to teach the 3rd graders, and I actually teach special ed, like I said, but I'm a 2nd and 3rd grade teacher. So it's cool to teach the little ones about basketball as well.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about these breakthrough basketball camps. You know, what's the structure? How are they put together? You're talking about they're all over the place. So if you make the pitch here, coach, for breakthrough basketball camps and why coaches should encourage their kids to go to something like that, or every summer I go to Snow Valley in Iowa, which is a huge fundamentals camp, and I mean it's very, very legendary in that regard. So, tell us a little bit about the Breakthrough Basketball. And what do you feel like kind of separates it from the rest of the camps that may be out there?
Sure. So we have a few different curriculums that we run. We have a fundamentals camp. We have a shooting camp. We have a counter and attack camp that teaches a lot of offensive moves and whatnot. And we have an elite skills camp for the older kids that are a little bit more advanced and want to play at that next level. That one actually is so cool because we break down film and whatnot. And it kind of simulates a college experience. It's great. But I think that the thing that sets Breakthrough apart is that we teach, and we teach a lot at the camps. And it's not your typical camp where you're playing 5-on-5. I mean, some of the camps, we don't even play 5-on-5 because that's not what's important, and that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to teach the kids different skills and whatnot. And we'll sprinkle in games here and there, but they're game-like to what we've been teaching all along so that they can carry the skills that they're learning into these games. And I just think it's incredible. I mean, they've given me such a great opportunity to go all around the country and travel. And in a few weeks, I'll be going to Minneapolis to run a camp. All summer, I'm up and down the East Coast running camp. So it's, like I said, it's just, I think it's one of the best camps out there. Mm-hmm. And we run them in every single state. So they're across the country. And there's multiple. We run, I think, over 300 camps at this point. So it's a phenomenal company. And we have some great camp leaders, that clinicians that we call them, that put on a really, really good few days for the kids.
Yeah. Like you said, year one. You just go out and win a state championship, no big deal. Just let it rip right away, And I'm sure there's no pressure of repeating and having to do it all over again. Hey, where do you go now, Christina? Where do you go?
Yeah. I mean, we're just trying to maintain that at Glen Ridge, because in the past, they've been good. And this year, I mean, we were exceptional, and we graduate three really, really good seniors, good basketball players, but just great people. And it's going to be tough next year, but we still have talent left over. And we're just trying to make it the standard at Glen Ridge, mm-hmm. That we are one of the best smaller schools in the state, because before this year, nobody really knew our name. So just making our name known, and hopefully to stay for a while now.
Yeah. What do you feel like? Obviously you have to have talent. I mean, that goes without saying, but what do you feel like you did well with this group to get them in this frame of mind, in the right place to make this run and to cut down the nets at the end of the season? What was kind of the growth process, and what did you emphasize to make things obviously this comfortable right from the get-go?
Right. I think, honestly, preparation. I think that was so, so big this year. And it was the same team from last year. Not many people graduated from the team last year, and they did well last year, but they weren't in the same division that we were this year. We moved up a division this year, and three of the teams in our division are in the top 15 in New Jersey. So mm-hmm. our schedule was brutal this year, and we still managed to do really, really well. But I think preparation, and I am huge into scouting, and I put so much time into scouting because that's something that I can control. And yep. If we know what the other team is doing, I know a lot of high school coaches don't. And I know at the college level, obviously everybody doesn't. So I kind of take that from what I did in the college level and took it down to the high school level. And we have access to a lot of the films. So I think that's one thing. And the team did say how how better prepared they felt because they knew the tendencies of the players and they knew what plays they were going to run and what we were going to do against them to counter what they do. Mm-hmm. So I think that was really, really big this year, and that made us as successful as we were.
What did you learn about yourself on this journey? How do you think you got better as you went through, you know, with, as you well know, every step along the way, every game, there's, I don't care what anybody says, there's a little bit more pressure. You're not dumb. You realize what you're playing for. So what did you learn about you as a coach as you went through this journey?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I'm such a competitor and I love to win, but I truly was trying to enjoy the ride this year because I feel like I put so much pressure on myself and on the kids. And at the end of the day, they're in high school. And for a lot of them, this is the last time they're ever going to play competitive basketball. So just trying to teach them that, yes, we want to win and we want to do well, but it's about enjoying the ride and being together. And I think we did a really, really good job of that. And just trying to keep it light and fun. I know a lot of the coaches, I mean, they live and die by this and the wins and the losses. And I mean, I want to win just as bad as the next person. But like I said, some of these kids are 15 years old and they're not going on to play basketball at the next level. So I just want to give them a really good experience. And I think I did a better job this year than I have in the past of just enjoying the moment and being in the moment.
Mm-hmm. When did you feel like, you know, we may or may not win a state championship, but we're going to be in the fight. We've got just as good a chance as everybody else does.
Right. I mean, early on when I saw what we were doing against some of these teams, even if we weren't winning games, I saw how competitive we could be. And there were glimpses. I mean, our first game in our division, we played the number 6 team in the state and we gave them a really good fight. Where last year they lost by 38 points when they played them. So mm-hmm. I'm looking at this and I'm like, this is essentially the same team and we're giving them a little bit of a fight. And then we started upsetting a few people and I think eyes began to open and I think my own eyes began to open and I'm like, okay, I have something very, very special in front of me. I think we can work with this a little bit.
Uh-huh. That's I've been there a couple of times where it's like, yeah, you can just feel it. Brewing.
Yes.
Yeah, you know. It's an exciting feeling, but then you're just, I don't know, you're kind of giddy. Would that be the right term?
Oh my gosh, yes. The day of the state championship game, I had to teach all day and I teach it in a different district than I coach in. And I was a wreck. I'm walking around with my second and third graders and thank God for them because they keep everything so light. But I was a nervous wreck.
That I can't, I don't know if that would be better or worse.
I know. And people were like, oh, take the day off. And I'm like, no, I need something to do because if not, I will freak out even more. So it was the best thing for me. My little ones got me through that.
Yeah. Awesome. As we get ready and I'm a little bit closer to summer vacation than you are, as we discussed here. So, you know, I'll be thinking about you on June 1st when I'm just kind of hanging out, but
I have 20 more days. Fine.
as you get closer to your summer basketball season, and I get it, you know, every state federation has their own rules and regulations, what you can and can't do with your kids. But what are you focused on for you, coach, as you step into your improvement season? What are some things that, what's one or two things that you're focusing on your own improvement and what you want to get better at here in the off season?
Right. I mean, I think it's always about just improving on whatever you need to improve on. And I think the biggest thing is just our defensive scheme for next year because we do lose a lot of that height. So just thinking of new defenses that are going to work and be successful towards the personnel that we have, I think that's the biggest thing that I'm going into this offseason with.
Mm-hmm. Are you looking in any certain direction, you know, anybody to kind of replicate and study, or are you just kind of taking a look at a lot of different things?
I am looking at everything and anything at this point. I mean, this past season, we ran a very high and wide 2-3 zone. And it wasn't your typical 2-3. We did some things out of it, but we had the length to run that. Next year, we're not at all. And we're slower next year. We're not big at all. So we're going to have to do some different things here and there. And I'm just trying to figure out what's going to be good because we go against a lot of teams that are a lot quicker than us.
Mm-hmm. Folks, we had a great day on April the 12th at the 5th annual A Pen and a Napkin Coaches Clinic. And if you couldn't be there, that stinks. But what's fortunate for you is we taped everything that we did. So if you are interested in ordering any of our clinic videos or all of our clinic videos from our great presenters on April the 12th, it's there for you. All you have to do is DM me on Twitter at a pen and a napkin. Email me apenandanapkin@gmail.com. We've got Andy King talking about 5-on-5 transition and controlled scrimmages. Jody Steyer from Iowa State University on player development. We've got Lucas Dollinghouse on coaching through an administrator's eyes. Wade Coulter talking about pressure defense and extending your pressure defense. Raz Vanderloo with a basketball smorgasbord of stuff from Sioux City East High School. USA Basketball, and Jamie Smith from Solon High School talking about shooting and shooting technique, shooting fundamentals. It's a great lineup, great coaches, great presentations. They're there for you. $10 a piece is all the videos cost. If you want to get all six of them, I'll bundle it together for you. $50 for all six videos. So coaches, if you weren't there, too bad, but because we're thinking ahead here, we've got the videos available for you. Give me a shout out. Let me know if you want to order any or all of the 5th annual A Pen and a Napkin Spring Clinic Coaches Presentations. Coach, let's if it's all right with you, Christina, let's talk a little John Wooden at this time. How's that sound? All right. The John Wooden quote of the day from Wooden, A Lifetime of Observations. Coach Danella, are you ready for the John Wooden quote of the day?
Well, let's hear it.
Page 13 of Wooden, A Lifetime of Observations. It's been a while since I've gone this early in the book here. So, but from page 13 of Wooden, A Lifetime of Observations, here is the John Wooden quote of the day. Build a shelter against a rainy day. This is not necessarily a material shelter. Your faith, whatever it may be, is the greatest shelter of all. In many ways, we've been taken in by materialism. I'm not saying possessions are unimportant, but we often put them out of proportion ahead of family, faith, and friends.
That's a good one. I like it.
Yeah. Why do you like it?
Wow. I mean, it's just deep and it's so true. Like, I think especially in the generation that we are in today, so many kids, I mean, they go to their phones and they go to their iPads and their electronic devices, and they don't play outside like we used to. Mm-hmm. And it's not about the material things. So I think, I mean, basketball can be a home for so many people, and it can be that esteem for so many people, as well as, like it says, faith, family, and whatnot. But I like.
Yeah. I think that one of the things that makes me think of is, you know, as the saying goes, the ball is going to stop bouncing at some point, whether you're a player or a coach. And what do you have other than if all you have is the wins and losses for however long you've played or however long you've coached or both, are you just going to walk up to everybody? Hey, I'm Marty Plum. I won, you know, X amount of games, and I won this many district championships, and we went to state this many times, and that's your whole identity. Okay. I really think that's not life. That's you're not coaching for the right reasons. Yes, you like you said, you want to win, but there's just so much more to it. I so cherish. And I'm a little bit more, as we say on the pod here, Coach, seasoned and experienced than you are. But I really value, I remember the games. I remember cutting down the nets a few times.
Of course.
Absolutely awesome. It's a tremendous feeling. But it's the friendships, it's the camaraderie, it's the, hey, you know, this tough thing happened here. I really need to lean on you right now. Or somebody asks you to, can I lean on you? I need your advice, whatever it may be. And I think that that's what life should be about. That's what we should be aiming to do. That's what we should be aiming to do as coaches as well for our players.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree more, because I always said when I was in the college game, like, my proudest moment will be watching my players walk across that stage. And it's not about the wins and losses. Yes, we want to cut down the nets. We keep saying that. But at the end of the day, it's watching them take that next step in life, whether it's walking across that graduation or getting that job or getting married, like things like that, that are big life moments that I love to see. And one of the best moments that I've had was at our state championship game this year. My point guard from Caldwell, who was the best point guard I've ever coached, a kid out of Jersey, I'll give her a shout out, Andy Lennon. Mm-hmm. She came to my game, and it was just her and her entire family. It gives me chills. She came to my game, and just to see that, I mean, I haven't talked to her in a few months, and we keep in touch here and there, but just for her to come to that game was such a big moment for me, because she didn't have to come, but she gave me a hug before the game, and I'm tearing up, because I mean, that's what it's all about. So
yeah, those are the best situations. And you know, the kids that you coach, you're going to have better relationships with some over others. You know, it's just natural. It's just human nature. But you hope that the kids who maybe you don't have that close relationship with, either while you're coaching them, unfortunately, or afterwards as you move on into life, you hope that, hey, you know, Coach Danella, I played for her, and there were times where it was very hard and very difficult, and I really didn't like playing for her. But now that I haven't played for her for 5 years, for 10 years, I see what she was talking about now. I understand that. And I think sometimes we kind of go in extremes at times, where we have certain coaches that want to be too friendly with the kids. They want to be their friend rather than their coach. And then you have other coaches who, again, that's the transactional. I've just won this many games, this many championships. It's got to be somewhere in between where, yeah, I'm going to hold you accountable, but I'm teaching you about life. But yeah, we still want to win games, and that's still really important to us as well. And I think that's the art of the craft that we're talking about.
I completely agree. And I just think that at times you have to show these kids that you're human as well. And you, obviously there's boundaries that you have to set. But if you're not building the relationships with the kids, I mean, you're never going to get the most out of it. I truly believe that. I think it's all about building the relationships and building that trust. And they need to know that at the end of the day, you're still a person and you want the best for them. So sometimes it takes tough love, and each kid is different, but I think that's super important.
Yep. Coach, let's get into your X's and O's philosophy here. Let's transition into that. Transition offense was something that you said you'd be willing to chat about here. So I'm going to turn it over to you, to Coach Danella. You know, what do you like to do when it comes to transition offense? What are you looking to emphasize? How do you implement it into your practices and your system? How do you get your kids to run your system, so forth and so on? I'm going to, as I tell everybody at this point, I'm going to try and sit back and just let you kind of cook here. Eventually, when I do interrupt, I will try to do so as politely as I possibly can. Talk to us and tell the listeners about your transition offensive philosophy.
So, I mean, we do want to play fast. And again, I understand the personnel that we have, but we want to get up and down the floor. Our biggest thing is, if there's somebody ahead of you, you have to throw the ball ahead. And that was a big thing early on when I first got hold of our high school team, is throwing the ball ahead and just being strong enough. We had to really work on that, because they weren't used to that. They were used to walking the ball up the floor and just making an easy pass. So early on last summer, we worked on throwing the long pass, because if there's somebody running the wing and they're ahead of you, I wanted them getting in the habit of, okay, somebody's ahead of me on the wing. I need to throw it ahead because we want to play fast. And you don't have to get anything out of it, but just to get the ball up and moving. In our transition offense, we run the same spots every single time, which I know is a little different than most. Technically our wings are interchangeable, but I love when we have the same kids in the same spot. So if they can sprint, if I have my two sprinting that right wing every single time, and I have my three sprinting that left wing every single time, that's what I want, because they're in positions out of our transition, if we don't get anything in transition, to run the plays that I want, because they're in the spots that they are in, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. So I usually my best shooter is usually my two, and I have her in that spot because our offensive sets are usually going to get her more shots than what my three will be doing. My five is always my rim runner, and they are to run to the front of the rim every single time and then post up hard. This year I had a phenomenal center. So we were great at that because she was very, very tough to guard. I mean, she was one of the best kids in the state. So that always makes it a lot better. And then I love a four that can trail and shoot the three. I mean, that's always, it just stretches the floor so much. So we want to play fast, but at the end of the day, we also want to play very, very smart in transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you were talking about those pitch ahead passes. Even if you just hit that a half dozen times in a game where you get something effective out of it, that puts so much pressure on the defense. And you hear the guy, get back. It's like, and what that also does by proxy is that helps alleviate teams pressing you, because they're worried about, you know, not being, you know, getting beat up the floor. So most coaches, when it comes down to it, and again, this is something that I was really proud of the way that we did things, especially we went through a stretch where I had two really, really good point guards, but we didn't get pressed very much because we were really disciplined with running our lanes. And what you were talking about, that's exactly what we did. The two always went right. The three always went left. The five was the rim runner, the old Loyola Marymount system. But those pitch aheads put so much pressure on them, and it's a game of chicken in a lot of ways when you do that, because it's like, we're going to keep running like this. If you want to press us, go ahead and try and press us. And you may get some turnovers, but we're going to keep coming at you. It's ingrained in us. This is what we're going to do. And who's going to back down first? And that's kind of the way I really thought of it from a psychological point of view.
I mean, that's a great point. And I love that, because we did struggle against the press this year. And I think we started off games really well in transition, and then we struggled with our depth this year, for sure. We would play 6-man, 7-man rotation if we were lucky. So I think as the game went on, we would struggle with that pitch ahead because they were tired. But I mean, it makes total sense for you to say that if you're pitching the ball ahead, they can't press you. And it's really smart.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, every once in a while, a blind squirrel finds a nut, coach, you know, so how do you implement that into your practice?
Yeah, so we do a lot of 5-on-0 drills with that, of just sprinting your spots on the floor and throwing ball ahead. We do one in particular where we do go in order, where the one is taking a shot first, and then we're throwing ahead to the two, and they're taking a shot, they're getting to the rim, taking a shot, then throwing ahead. Two skips to the three, and we're just going through it just so that they get used to sprinting the spots and where the passes should be and whatnot, and what we're going to run out of it.
Mm-hmm. So you go from your transition offense into your half court offense. How do you kind of flow into that? And what do you like to do when you get into those 5-on-5 situations? God forbid that would happen at some point, that you end up playing 5-on-5. You know, as I used to tell the first time we would introduce our cycles, you know, kind of what you're talking about there, I was saying, you know, girls, at some point, unfortunately, the other team is going to score on us, so we're going to have to figure out what to do next. You know, kind of. tongue in cheek, you know, bad dad humor, I guess would be the way you would say it. But, what do you do with that? How do you transition out of that and go from your transition offense into your half court? And what do you like to run after that,
So all of our, sets out of transition, the players were already in their spots that we needed. So we always had, it was a 4-out, 1-in. But our main offense this year, since I did have a 5 that, I mean, she was back to the basket, but she could also step out and hit the 3. We went to a 5-out. And what we did was very similar to what Harry Perretta would run at Villanova when he was there. So we would run a motion offense. We had numbers for all of our cuts. And it was very structured, but at the same time, it gave the players freedom to read screens and react to what the defense was doing. And it took a while to implement. It really, really did, because I don't want to say it's confusing, but it's intricate and the players have to have a basketball IQ for it. And this is something that I ran when I was coaching in college and it worked great. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think I could run it at the high school level. And up until this year, I never got the chance to run it correctly at the high school level. Mm-hmm. And I have some players that had higher basketball IQ this year. So I was like, oh, let's give it a whirl. Let's see. And I mean, it worked wonders for us this year. It really, really did. So we would get right into that. And then if we wanted a specific 3 or whatnot, we would run some of our sets. We didn't really have too many sets because our motion offense was our main offense this year.
What was it about that system, that motion system, that made it so intricate and you needed that high basketball IQ? Can you give us kind of, I know it's difficult in the medium that we have here, but, you know, kind of try to describe it to the best of your ability.
Sure. So how the system works is I'll call out. So every single cut on the floor has a number. And if any of the coaches that I play against are listening, I'm not going to give out all our numbers, or I might have to switch it up next year. But so say a basket cut is a 1 cut. And then a curl cut is a 2. So how the system works is I will call out 2 numbers. So I'll call out 12. And our players know that the first 2 cuts of our offense, so our point guard will pass. The first cut is a basket cut. Our next kid will pass. The next cut is a basket cut. Once we make 2 cuts off of our first number, so it's 12, it's our 1 cuts, we go all into 2 cuts. So our next one is pass, screen away, we curl cut, and then we replace. Mm-hmm. And it's tough because there's 6 different numbers out of it. And the combination that we do, I mean, you can essentially run how many different, I mean, we can call out 64, we can call out 25, like whatever it may be, we're calling out different numbers every single time. So it's really tough for other teams to scout. Mm-hmm. And if the coaches do figure out our cuts of our numbers, I mean, that's great, but then they have to defend against it. Yeah. So there's not much time in between our games. I mean, I know our division games are, it's game, practice, game. So they have to prep against us for one day. And I think that's pretty tough for them to scout against. And so I think our kids, I mean, they got it down really, really well as the season went on and they just got more confident playing in this system. But I just think it's great because they can make reads out of it and they can create it out of it. And at any time they can post. So if they basket cut and they have a smaller kid on them, they have a 2 count in the post. Yeah. If they don't get the ball after 2, they get out, they replace. And that's how we ran.
Yeah. We did something similar to that, but, you know, not obviously not the same. I didn't make many scouting trips to New Jersey last year. So, we everybody had a job. We had cutters, which so you touch it and I throw it to Christina. I cut. I basket cut every time. And everybody knows I'm a basket cutter. We had zippers where I touch it, I throw it to Christina, I go and I screen away every single time. And now that gal who's making the read on the screen away, you know, she can curl, she can slip, she can run a straight cut, whatever it may be, you know, but they're playing that 2-person game. So we had cutters, we had zippers, we had jokers, so they would catch it. I throw it to you, Christine. If I'm a joker, I throw it to you. I'm following you with a ball screen. And then we had our Mavericks, where that was, if you throw it to the Maverick, you go ball screen for the Maverick. If the Maverick throws you the ball, they're coming to screen for you as well, kind of like a joker. So, you know, your Mavericks were essentially your most skilled players, because we wanted to get them in the most two-person action that we possibly could.
Of course.
You know, so that's, in some ways, it sounds like it's kind of a first cousin of what you were doing, you know.
Yeah, I really like that, though. And I feel like you could run that with, I mean, anybody, but that sounds, I feel like, a little bit more simple than what we were doing, but still really good and hard to scout again.
Well, yeah, and we could adjust it to, yeah, you know, we could go four out, we could go five out, yeah, we could go four out with a on, you know, strong side post player. We would, you know, for 1 year we ran it four out and we kept our post players, quote unquote, in the dunker spot, because we didn't want her posting up. We wanted to, you know, that wasn't her strength, but being in the dunker spot was her strength, you know? So we did, you know, you could make those changes kind of on the fly or adjust the system to your personnel a little bit more. And if you had all cutters, you had all cutters and you got really good at cutting and, you know, that type of thing. So, you know, it worked for us. I really liked it. And we just spent a lot of time breaking it down. And here's how to read a screen. And here's how you come off a ball screen. And
right.
You know, when we were practice, everybody kind of did a little bit of everything. And we gave them enough freedom to where it was like, okay, if you're a joker and you're going to set the ball screen, but you see them, they're going to hedge it hard, go ahead and slip it before you kind of ghost it before you even get there or whatever it may be. But that, again, that requires a lot of basketball IQ and a lot of reps and practice, you know, and
right.
You know, but that's what we did. And it worked well for us, even when we didn't have the greatest of skilled players.
Yeah.
It was a good system for us to run because it just simplified everything, but it wasn't a flex or something like that where it's highly scoutable. And if you take this away, you could kind of kill the offense. So that's what I liked about it. So
I love it. Awesome. You're going to have to use that sometime.
Well, there you go. Idea number two for Glenridge, New Jersey. There you go.
Love it.
Yeah. Coaches, are you looking for a great sports story to read? Then look no further than Kings of Their Court, the story of three great high school basketball teams in the heartland of America. Millard North, Bellevue West, and Creighton Prep, all out of Omaha, Nebraska, all ranked in the top 25 in the country for the 2020-21 season in the middle of so much chaos that we all lived through. COVID quarantine, politics, racial issues, some of the best players that the city of Omaha has ever produced, and the stories of them, their parents, and their coaches all wrapped up into one here. All you need to do is go to Amazon.com, type in Kings of Their Court, and order yourself a copy today. Coaches, go check out Kings of Their Court. Want to know more about a pen and a napkin and all the resources it offers? Go to apenandanapkin.com, a great resource for any coach at any level. In addition to our A Pen and a Napkin University video library options that are available to order, we have hundreds of pages of notes, from one-page handouts to book breakdowns to original coaching notes. We also have coaching links, a full catalog of every A Pen and a Napkin podcast, and ways to contribute to the growth of A Pen and a Napkin. apenandanapkin.com is a coaching resource that will help you become a better coach. Coach, let's pivot a little bit away from motion offense here. Communicating with parents, and you've been again on a couple of different sides of things here. Obviously, as a special ed education teacher, you're spending a lot of time communicating with parents, especially at the elementary level. You've recruited kids, so that's a different type of communication that you've had with parents. You're coaching high school kids now. That's another level and a different relationship that you have with communicating with parents. So, I mean, boy, I'm guessing you have all the answers on how to communicate with parents, Coach Danala, and everything is taken care of. So coaches, get out your notepads after these next 5 minutes or so. We'll never have a question to ever answer.
Oh, I wish I did. honestly, it's tough, and parents are involved and super involved. And I think it's just about setting expectations early. We always have a parent expectation meeting at the beginning of the season. And I think that's huge. And I think that lays the groundwork for what I need from them for the season. And I have a 24-hour rule for the parents, because nothing good comes of a conversation right after a game when tensions are high and emotions are high. So it's a 24-hour rule, but the rule also goes to, especially at the high school level, I didn't have this in college. At the high school level, the player needs to talk to me first. And if they're not going to talk to me, but a parent's going to reach out, I need to hear from the player first. And we need to have a conversation together before I talk to any parents. And I don't love parent conversations, but at the same time, I realize that, like I said before, these kids are 15, 16 years old. So parents are still very, very involved. But at the parent meeting, I mean, I always try to preach that we're trying to get them to grow up and trying to get them to be young women that are independent, and their next step is to go to college, and they're not always going to have mom and dad to run back to and get them out of certain things. So there's going to be hard conversations between a coach and a player at times. And I ask the parents to let that go through before they come to me and, or even above me at times. But I think expectations are so big. And if you don't have this, the parents don't know what to expect. So they don't know what the boundaries are. And I had a set of good parents this year. And I think it was because of this preseason meeting that we had. And I feel like they knew that I just wanted the best for their kids. And I think that's what it comes down to at the end of the day. And at the college level, it's different because they're grownups. And playing time is such a hard thing at the college level. I never talk to parents about playing time. It was never that, but that was made clear in the recruiting process.
Yeah.
And it has to be. So, I mean, back to the high school level, I always left our meetings with, your job as a parent is to be your daughter's number one fan. I'm going to critique her. I'm going to coach her hard. I'm going to sometimes be really, really hard on her. Sometimes you're going to have to put your arm around her and pull her in. But at the end of the day, the parents need to be their daughter's number one fan. So that was my ask of them this year. And I think they did a really, really good job of that.
Is part of your pitch, I guess it would be, to your parents, you gotta let me coach your kid. And there's gonna be ups and downs, and there's gonna be failures. And if you don't let me be that singular instructional voice, I know you're trying to help your child, but in some ways you're making it more difficult because now he or she is hearing from multiple voices, and it's my mom or it's my dad or whatever it may be. I think sometimes that's the hardest thing that coaches have to deal with, is just let me coach your kid. I want to do what's best for them. I believe me, I'm going to do everything I can. I don't think that there's too many coaches that say, you know, I'd rather just play six kids the entire season because of this. You know, I want to play as many kids as I can every single game, but also give us the best chance to win a game. And some nights that's nine kids, and some nights that's six kids. But you gotta let me coach your child. You've got to understand that I've got their best interests in mind, but I also, when it comes, if I have a choice between their best interests and the team best interests, I always have to take the team's best interests. And please trust me that's the thought process that I'm using.
Absolutely. And it's, like you said, it's so tough when they're hearing my voice, but then they're hearing mom or dad in the stand saying, shoot the ball. And that's that might not be what we're preaching in practice every single day. So that's the difficult conversations that I don't like having, because the player is conflicted, because at the end of the day, they have to go home to their parents and they're hearing it from their parents at home. So I get it, but at the same time, that's when I have to step in as a coach. And that's when I don't mind stepping in, because I've experienced a high level as a player, as a coach. I've been successful. So I try to ask them, you guys can cheer as loud as you want. That is amazing. And that's what I want. But as far as coaching goes, like, please keep that to me and my staff.
The worst ones, the ones that I really, I'll be honest with you, I lost a lot of respect for, were the parents or the grandparents. They're twofold, where they were either the ones that were keeping score and keeping track of minutes in the stands that drove me nuts, or the parent or the grandparent. And actually, this happened a couple of times with our kids, as they were going through the sporting experience. Hey, you know what? We told Billy before the game that if he scores 12 points, we'll take him out to eat, you know, his choice, wherever he wants. And I was like, and I actually had to tell one or two of our parents that we are, you know, our kids were playing together. I said, I'm sorry. I have to tell you this. That is the worst thing you can do, because all that kid is concerned about right now is scoring X amount of points so they can get what they want. You are defeating the purpose of the team concept here and the construct. And they didn't, you know, one of them didn't take to it very well. And I'm like, tough, you know, I'm exactly. Just telling you in this. And lo and behold, the kid, I guess I would use the term underachieved when he got to the high school level, you know, and I think those are the two, for me, those were the two toughest ones that I had to deal with.
Of course. I totally get that.
Yeah. So, so you solved all the parenting problems for every coach in America here, coach, in the last 10 minutes?
That's all it was, guys. Plain and simple.
Yep, exactly. I think sometimes, though, when it comes to parents, 90 to 95% of our parents are really good parents and are usually really, really supportive. It's just the 5%. It's just like in the classroom. 95% of our kids are really, really good kids. It's the 5% that distract us. And it's the same thing when you're dealing with parents, don't you think?
Exactly. And sometimes they just want to talk it out. I mean, not talk, but yell, but they just want to vent. They really do. And once they get it out, I feel like it's out. And then they can breathe a little bit, whether it goes anywhere or not. But they sometimes just want to get it off their chest. And I mean, as a coach, obviously, that's really frustrating. But sometimes that's all they need, is to just know that the coach knows. And it might not change a thing in the world, but that changes everything for them. So it's weird how that works, but it has to happen.
Mm-hmm. Let's wrap up here, coach. Let's talk a little baseline on bounce plays. What you like to do, how you put your things together. Again, kind of like with everything else, if I need to interrupt, I'll try to do so as politely as I can here. But tell us what you're doing there, Christina, with your baseline out of bounds system.
Sure. So we do a lot of our out of bounds. Well, I should say all of our out of bounds out of a box set, and it's always the same spots for all the kids, and we just have different names for them. Just goes back to the whole, we don't want to be scoutable. I watch it when I'm scouting other teams, and they'll put the big on the block, and then they'll pop the big out, and then they'll pass up, and then they'll screen for the shooter coming in. Like, we call it America's play, because everybody in the world runs it, and we know when they're running it. So we just try to be as unscoutable as possible, and we'll run a lot of back screen things. And this year, honestly, we weren't great at out of bounds plays, and I chalk it up to because we weren't great at setting screens, and that's also something we have to get better at. And you would think with a team that was so big in size, we would set screens, and we set screens on air. That was our biggest thing this year, on air. So we kept preaching, like, find a body, hit a body. Like, I would love to see you get a foul, because you are setting a screen hard and moving and actually hitting somebody. Like, please go get that foul instead of setting a screen on air. Mm-hmm. But we, in the college game, when I was in the college game, we would always run it out of a box set, and we had a bunch of different things, just a ton of back screen things and misdirections of our shooter always going to the corner. So that's drawing people out, and then just a misdirection the opposite way. I think that's great, because then that opens up the slip so much. And we would run a box set, whether it's against the man, whether it's against the zone. And again, it all goes back to the screens. If you're hitting a body on the screens, somebody is going to be open.
Yeah.
So that's been successful.
Mm-hmm. I really think you brought up back screens, because you don't see them very often in women's and girls basketball. I think if you have a team that can run really, really good fade cuts and back screens, and then you can either pop or slip off of those, I think that is a really underutilized weapon within any sort of, whether it's a set play or your motion offense or a baseline out of bounds play, whatever it may be, that's really underutilized a lot of times.
It really is. And I mean, when you said the fade screen, like, that was part of our offense this year. And if we needed a three, we would run our one specific set that I knew our shooter was getting a three every single time, because it was a double fade screen and teams couldn't defend it. It's really tough. And then if they're going to defend it, we have our big kids flipping to the basket. I mean, something was open every single time off of that one set. So, but I agree with you. I think it's underutilized at this point.
Yeah. So see, we've, in this podcast, in the last 15 minutes, we've solved every parent problem and every single way that we can get an open shot. Just run back screens, just continuously run back screens. And you're going to get a great look every single time. So there you go. This is the last A Pen and a Napkin podcast ever. We have solved the game of basketball right here.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely love it.
Yeah. Christina Danella, thanks so much for coming on here. If folks want to know more about you, want to know more about your program, how can they find out more?
Sure. My Instagram is Coach Danella. And I am public, and I put a bunch of our Breakthrough Basketball camps information on there, as well as my Glen Ridge stuff. So please reach out. I will get back to you if anybody has any questions.
Perfect. Perfect. So, Coach, how was the maiden voyage on A Pen and a Napkin podcast?
Absolutely loved it. Thank you so much for having me.
Good. You did a great job. Appreciate your time. Sorry, I lost 15 minutes of your life there waiting for me to call earlier today. I entered in the, I'm going to out myself here. I entered the wrong number into my contact list, and I'm like, where is Coach Danella? And then, yeah, I checked the number. I entered it in wrong. So, I'm a genius here. So, no, Coach, hold on to the line here in just a second. Christina Danella, head girls basketball coach, Glen Ridge High School, Glen Ridge, New Jersey. Really fun conversation with her today. Really enjoyed it. Of course, we want to thank our founding sponsor, Cosac Chiropractic, here in Omaha. If you're in need of chiropractic services, like I said, don't hesitate to reach out to Dr. Kevin or Dr. Heidi. Follow us on Twitter at @apen and a napkin. Download, rate, review, give us 5 stars. Subscribe if you would, please. That would be great. Questions, comments, suggestions, ideas, email me apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Go to apenandanapkin.com. A lot of really good stuff there. We've just got a lot of irons in the fire, as always, with A Pen and a Napkin, and trying to do the best that we can for you, the coaching community. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.